This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys. Place to Be Nation listeners, we have survived the blip, and we're back right home in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, at Ho-Ho-Loon. Listen to me, out of practice here. Ho-Ho-Loon Plaza, inside the hard-traveling L-shaped studios. I'm Greg Phillips, with me is Nick Duke, and we are the hard-traveling fanboys. The longest-running,
weekly,
episodic
comic book podcast
in all of Place to Be Nation.
Yep, that's it. That's us. We are those people.
We are indeed. Now, Nick, it's been a big week.
Mm-hmm.
A big week for us. Well, for you. For me, it really just hasn't been much of anything, but it has been a week. But for you, you've gone on a sabbatical. You've gone on a walkabout, Nick.
Not really a walkabout so much as a sit and then stumble about. Went on a little beach vacation with the family there, and it was certainly a thing that happened is the best way I can describe it.
The thing that happened. Now, I heard a couple of rumors from this. I actually got some notes passed along by one of our listeners about some things that happened on that on that trip.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things is I understand that you blew out your flip flop.
Mm.
I understand that you stepped on a pop top and cut your heel, and that's actually why you had to cut your vacation a day short and cruise on back home.
You know, that's true. The one thing I know is it's old Stone Cold's fault.
Remember that rock band Boston, Nick?
No.
Rock band Boston?
Neither do I. So
yeah. I don't remember the words to any of their songs right now. Anyway, in any event, we do have a happening episode for you folks, because if there's one thing you should have learned this summer from listening to the Hard Traveling Fanboys, it's that we always have our middle finger on the pulse of pop culture.
Indeed.
Hence why we have these wonderful theme months.
Yes.
That we could do for the end of time, Nick. We could do nothing but theme months the rest of our lives.
Either we got to come up with another theme month for September, or we got to come up with a damn, for August and September, I should say, or we got to come up with a damn regular recurring feature to rotate in, because we're running out of time, Greg. We're running out of time.
Well, there comes a time in any great booker's life when you start the creative well starts to run dry. You know, it happened to Watts. You know, it happened to Crockett. Happened to Dusty. It's happening to Vince. You know, and eventually, one has to think it might happen to the hard traveling fanboys, Nick. We might just run out of ideas and find ourselves regurgitating things that the audience outright rejects.
Well, that's possible. That's possible. And as we all know, the worst thing you could possibly do is repeat topics on a podcast, but that's neither here nor there.
We've never done that before and never will again.
No.
Because right now we're offering you, hot off the presses, it's a little bit of newspaper terminology for those of you that may not know that. Newspapers are these things that people used to read at one time and that we foolishly started working in after the time when people read them. We have got a review of the hottest number one movie in America. That movie is the latest entry in the Marvel Cinematic Universe pantheon, and it is titled Spider-Man Far From Home. Currently sitting at $92.7 million for its opening weekend. Now, those of you who have been longtime followers of the show understand that the predecessor of this film, Spider-Man Homecoming, also by director John Watts, who returned for Far From Home, was something of a divisive film amongst the hard-traveling fanboys in that both of us liked the movie. Nick adores the movie.
Yes.
And I find the movie just good enough. So, going into this one, Nick's expectations were sky high for what he wanted from the sequel. My expectations were pretty low for it. I hoped that I would like it better than Homecoming. I suspected I might, but I wasn't sure. And we both walked into it, and interestingly enough, had opposite experiences on our first viewings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Nick, you have now seen it twice, and yes. I understand that your perspective on the film changed between viewings one and two.
Yeah, pretty good bit, actually. So, not to get into all the machinations behind the reasoning of it, but for reasons that will be left unsaid, I had to cut our family vacation short a day early. And so that day when we were coming home from St. George Island, Florida, which is a good like 4-hour drive for me from my house, I was already in a bad mood because I don't like cutting vacations short. You know, I took a lot of time off and I wanted to get maximized life's minutes, as old JR would say.
Mm-hmm.
And then that day I had something spoiled for me about the film. And by the way, we should go ahead and say, I don't know if you agree, Greg, I feel like it's almost impossible to talk about this film
yes.
without talking about some spoilers. So
I don't think that it's impossible to review the movie without spoilers, but I think in our case, I don't really want to avoid spoilers. So.
Right. So we're just going to go ahead and say now, the rest from here on out, spoiler filled. So I had the mid-credit scene of the film, which we'll talk about in a little bit. I had the presence of a certain character spoiled for me. In an article that purported to be non-spoiler free. It was just supposed to be an article talking about like what the terms of the Sony and Marvel agreement were as it related to Spider-Man, just how many films were left on it and that kind of stuff. I was not expecting to have a spoiler just dropped in the middle of it, but I did. So I'm coming home from my vacation a day early. I've got a mild ear infection that is starting to bother me. I've just read the spoiler, and so now I feel like I have to go to the theater as soon as I get home before the rest of the movie is spoiled for me. I'm exhausted. Like I go see like a 10:30 p.m. screening after being at the beach with a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old all week. Like I'm a little hungover. Let's put all the cards on the table. I'm in a bad mood, honestly, when I walk into this theater. And as much as I was looking forward to the movie, the first half of the movie, as we'll discuss, relies heavily on the audience being willing to go along with the movie in terms of how it's trying to portray the character of Mysterio. And me being a comics fan, I was very impatient with it. I was just wanting the movie to hurry up and get to the twist that I was like, I read comics, so I know the twist is coming. Just hurry up and get to the twist. And so the first half of the movie kind of felt
like what you wanted, Nick, let's be honest. Let's call it what it is. You wanted to twist again like you did last summer.
Indeed. But no, I guess I felt like the first half of the film was just kind of treading water for me the first time I saw it. I was just kind of wanting to fast forward and get to the back half. But even on first viewing, in as bad a mood as I was, I loved the back half of the film. So then turn it around and see it again on Sunday.
You love to watch it strut.
With my wife, which was always our original plan, was a Sunday matinee when we got back from our vacation, which we kept tickets to that. Went and saw it again and completely did a 180 on the beginning of the film. Now I love the film all the way through. But my own bad mood caused me to not have a optimal first viewing of it.
Which is quite interesting, Nick, because on the contrary, my first and thus far only viewing experience of the film was quite the opposite of what one might have expected, given my thoughts on Homecoming after multiple watches. I left the theater grinning, much like Kano described his opponent in the Mortal Kombat film from ear
to ear.
I thought it was wonderful. Absolutely thought it was I left the theater calling Spider-Man Mr. Wonderful. He is Mr. Wonderful. No, I left the theater very impressed by the movie. I thought it was surprisingly great in many ways. And so let's get into it. Let's get into the movie right now and talk a little bit about it. Obviously, following on the heels of Spider-Man Homecoming, which introduced us to the MCU version of Peter Parker, once again, a high schooler played by Tom Holland, and his cast of characters, his best friend Ned Leeds. I almost said Ned Beatty, and that would have been a different movie. And his high school friends, you've got Betty Brant in there. You've got, of course, their version of MJ, which is not Mary Jane Watson, but Michelle Jones, I think. And
have they given her a last name? I don't know.
It's
maybe in the credits or something, but I'm not doubting you. It's just it all of a sudden occurs to me. I don't know that I know her last name.
Well, quite frankly, yes, her name is Michelle MJ Jones. Michelle Jones. Played by Zendaya, who is a well-known figure in music and pop culture at the moment. And yes, and who else was introduced in that? So you meet the Vulture, of course. He's not in this one. Mm-hmm. And of course, you get to the establishment of Peter Parker's relationship with Tony Stark as a father figure, mm-hmm. which and I should also mention Marissa Tomei as Aunt May, of course.
Good Lord, man.
And so Peter Parker's relationship with Tony Stark sort of forms the emotional core in some ways of the last film, and that carries through into what we've seen of him since that movie in Avengers Infinity War, and then especially in Avengers Endgame. And this movie picks up, we're not going to go plot point by plot point, but this movie picks up in the aftermath of Endgame. Peter and seemingly virtually any of the classmates that meant anything in the movie all got taken away in Thanos' snap and brought back 5 years later at the same age they were when the snap happened.
Yeah, the one exception, I think, was the African kid who was on the quiz team in the first movie. He was not in this movie, or if he was, he didn't have any speaking lines. So I assume he did not get snapped. So at least there's one there.
And so they come back and I think Aunt May got snapped too, right?
Yeah, she made reference to that in the fundraiser scene near the beginning of the movie.
So all the supporting characters that meant anything were snapped away, and they come back and they're back from what they refer to as the blip. They all have to go back to high school, resume their lives as they were before they left. So it's pretty, but that's sort of almost irrelevant, because we don't really focus as much on that as we do on the emotional fallout of Tony Stark's death and what effect that's had on Peter. He is taking it very hard. He is having a hard time readjusting to his life post-blip. He is having a hard time readjusting to being Spider-Man post-blip. Interestingly, Nick, one of those scenes that we saw in the trailers did not appear in the movie, now that I think about it. The scene with him and the cops?
Mm-hmm. Apparently, John Watts in an interview, I don't know who he gave the interview to in the last couple of days, but I saw it floating around online, that that scene will be used in a short film for the Blu-ray release.
Oh, very good. Very good. In any event, this film takes place sort of in the mourning period still for Peter Parker. He's not sure what he wants to do. He feels the weight of expectations trying to fill in for Tony Stark, and he really just wants to get away from it all. He wants to go on this European vacation alongside the Griswolds. They're planning on going over there and touring Big Ben and all the exciting sights of Europe, and should be pretty good, Nick.
Yeah, should be. Seems like a pretty good, you know, set up for Peter to get away and kind of de-stress a little bit. And of course, in true Peter Parker fashion, that of course is not what winds up happening.
No. So as Peter goes overseas, he encounters a series of calamities in the forms of his attempts at wooing MJ, who in between the two films, he has sort of developed an affection for. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, because they say at the beginning of the film, they set up that an entire school year has passed mm-hmm. since the events of Endgame. So we are meeting them at the end of the school year. They're going on a little summer vacation, you know, kind of thing. So seemingly during the course of this school year, he has developed these feelings for MJ that were kind of subtly hinted about at the end of Homecoming.
Which is a little bit of a Walking Dead thing to do with off camera
yeah.
developments, but notwithstanding, quite frankly, in this case he is attempting to woo her. He wants her to be wooed by him, is what mm-hmm. I'm getting at. And in the process, his buddy Ned finds love on
now.
The
if he
plane.
Wants to woo her, I mean, they are getting on a plane, Greg. From what I understand, the best way to woo someone on a plane is to take off all your clothes and go get a bejeweled or feathered robe and then walk up to the person you're trying to woo and just open it so that your genitalia is directly in front of them.
Yes, so that they can see the baby's arm holding an apple.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that works for some people from the North Carolina area most of the time. But yes, the wooing does not go as Peter plans throughout his trip for the most part. And then in the midst of that, he also finds himself unable to escape superheroics as he has to intervene to help when these natural disasters start occurring around the globe involving creatures that resemble the earth or resemble water or resemble fire, the elements, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Elementals, one might say. And he meets a new hero in the form of Jake Gyllenhaal, who is playing an individual named Quentin Beck, who shows up wearing the classic Mysterio costume and seemingly fighting off these elementals. Nick Fury and Maria Hill call Spider-Man into action, and what proceeds is a classic Spider-Man tale of trying to help others while trying to maintain his secret identity, while also trying to pursue the girl that he's interested in, and his competing interests of his what he feels is his responsibility to the world and what he feels is his true desire to just be a normal kid, to be a normal high schooler. And I think that's an immortal story, Nick, that you can go back to time and time again with Peter Parker, especially at a young age. Is that dichotomy, is the challenge that we see with a lot of superhero characters who might, you know, the classic, you know, Superman and Clark Kent thing. But with Spider-Man, you add the extra element of him being in high school, dealing with hormones, dealing with everything under the sun that you deal with at that age. So it's a pretty interesting story from that standpoint anyway. And adding all of these different layers on top of it, it all makes sense why Peter would fall for, spoiler alert, the illusion of Mysterio, who is a creation of this group of people that have allied themselves with Quentin Beck. And it's a really cleverly built story because I bought that Peter Parker, even though he's supposed to be this really smart kid, would fall for this, given everything in his life, everything that had built to this moment. It makes perfect sense that he's really looking for a reason to give up being Spider-Man. And especially to give up the sort of role of being Tony's successor.
Right.
As Tony leaves him this Stark tech to
and
take over for him.
It's a great flip of the main theme of Homecoming. In Homecoming, Peter's entire arc is about wanting to do too much, about wanting to step up and be viewed as an Avenger, essentially, as one of the world's most important heroes in a time in his life where he clearly just isn't ready for it in terms of maturity. Here, because of the events of Infinity War and Endgame, it's time for him to step up. Now is the right time. He's seen enough. He's learned enough. He's been chosen, essentially, and yet now he wants so badly that life that he feels like he's missing out on. So it's a great flip on that. The Mysterio stuff, as you just said, like I said earlier, first time through the film, I was impatient with it. Second time through, I totally got it. It was really, really well done. And credit to Jake Gyllenhaal for giving a, you know, he could have been twirling his mustache in every scene, even before the twist, and it would have lessened it at some point. But there are some really good scenes where he's trying hard to counsel Peter, or you really start to buy why Peter would feel a connection to this guy.
Yeah, he comes off so genuine
right.
in those scenes that even I, even I was starting to fall for it. And I was thinking, what if the multiverse is real and we end up getting a replacement Quentin Beck that's evil? Because this one, he was doing such a good job of there were some tells along the way that kind of gave it away that he was not all he claimed to be. But he was doing such a good job in those mentorship roles. And you can see that Peter was looking for a replacement father figure in his life, somebody to step in and replace Tony as that shoulder to lean on for him. And Quentin Beck steps in and instantly earns his spot in Spider-Man's Rogues Gallery for his deception and his very clever plan. And, you know, let's talk about that. You know, Jake Gyllenhaal has big shoes to fill in this one because, in my estimation, the best part of Spider-Man Homecoming, one that I would never take issue with, was Michael Keaton's performance as the Vulture. A truly transformative performance for that character, taking a character I had always considered to be lame and making that character have relevancy in 2019 or 2017 in a way that I never thought he could, honestly. I was so bummed out when I heard that Michael Keaton was playing the Vulture. He comes in, he does a great job, plays a very compelling villain, one of the best Marvel villains to this point. So Gyllenhaal has to fill those roles in the form of Mysterio, a character that has a fishbowl helmet, which puts you at somewhat of a disadvantage. However, I'm happy to report that while he doesn't quite match Michael Keaton's Vulture for me, he isn't too far off that path.
No, he's damn good,
This was a really good performance and a really good usage, again, of a Spider-Man villain that could have been very difficult to bring to the big screen, and instead they put some thought into it, and they made changes that made sense, and they made Mysterio work in a way that that I didn't think he necessarily could in a movie. So, excellent job here by John Watts and company.
Absolutely. You know, first off, we have to remind people, you know, if you listen to our giant size MCU retrospective, the consensus of our Hard Travelers for Hire guests is that Vulture is a top five MCU villain. So when we say that Mysterio isn't quite up to the level of the Vulture, that's a high bar to set. But like you said, he's damn close. He would probably slot into a top 10 or, you know, definitely an upper half of MCU villains.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about the Mysterio character is we had always talked about it for years, about the idea of doing a Mysterio film, and I think the costume was always, you know, one that was one of the barriers to it. Honestly, special effects, even back during the Raimi films, probably would have been a barrier to doing what they were able to do in this film with Mysterio. And you and I discussed this off-air earlier this week, and another thing, I almost feel like doing Mysterio and this version of Mysterio in 2019 is more relevant than like any other version of Mysterio I've ever encountered. Because
yes,
this entire Mysterio is built on misleading a public, making them believe a narrative for his own personal gain. And the thought is that, you know, people are so willing to believe whatever they are seen or shown, and that they are so open and susceptible to manipulation, and they're so naive and gullible, and it just speaks to the era that we live in, where we have an aging generation who is really starting to interface with social media for the first time, and we see millions of people who will believe a lie just because somebody says it, and it is remarkable. So like, this version of Mysterio is almost providing this subtle commentary on the fake news era, and it works, man. Like, this updated version of Mysterio, I mean, probably my favorite version of Mysterio I've ever encountered, comics, animated series, or otherwise.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I've always liked Mysterio since I was a kid.
As a concept,
He's a villain I always wanted them to do in the Sam Raimi movies because of the concept was
cool. Well, the old fan theory was always that that Bruce Campbell was Mysterio.
Right. And they probably wouldn't have been able to pull it off at that time and make it like it probably needed to be, but I'm glad they finally did find a way to make it work. Because and Mysterio is a character I've liked, the look of. He's great look, great concept, but I never found a Mysterio story. We talked about this a little bit last week. I never found a Mysterio story that really clicked with me and stood out in my mind as a great story.
There is one, but it's not a Spider-Man story. The Kevin Smith Daredevil.
Oh, yeah.
fantastic Mysterio story. Arguably, probably my favorite Mysterio story I've ever read, but not a Spider-Man story, interestingly enough.
Oh, well, what about Old Man Logan as well?
Oh, yeah, that's a great one as well. I forgot about that. Yeah, so, and also not a Spider-Man story, so.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, but so this, I agree with you. This is the best version of Mysterio I've come across. They even though they do that thing that I kind of hate in Marvel movies where they kill the villain and is seemingly taken off the table, they left themselves enough outs with that because of the way it's done that they could always bring Mysterio back. And, hell, they could even bring Jake Gyllenhaal back as Mysterio because of the way they pulled this whole thing off. With, you know, this technology called Edith, and at a certain point in the movie, Peter cedes all control over Edith to Quentin Beck. And then at the end of the movie, he just takes it back from Beck and reasserts control. But I would think that Beck would have perhaps had to have some sort of input in that process to allow Edith right. just to go right back over to control to Peter. So
I mean, maybe he is actually dead, but me personally, I'm not going to be surprised at all if he pops up in a future film, whether it be through a projection or an actual appearance, right. physical appearance by Jake Gyllenhaal. So all good stuff. One thing before we move on from Mysterio, we got to talk about some of the special effects sequences they have in this film involving mm-hmm. him, particularly the one I believe it's set in Berlin. Yeah, Peter is in a building that he believes to be the headquarters of Europol, European police, and what follows is perhaps one of my favorite visual sequences I've ever seen in a Spider-Man film. I mean, it is remarkable. I was loving every single second of that.
Yeah, it's tremendous. It really is. That's the point in the movie when I was fully won over, because yep. another one of my problems with Homecoming was I thought the action was extremely lackluster, uninventive, unimpressive in many ways, and all of those concerns got addressed in this movie big time. And that was the scene in which I was like, okay, I'm fully in now. I'm fully invested in this movie. They've done it. They've completely won me over on this take on Spider-Man. So that sequence is wonderful for so many reasons. Visually, it's stunning, obviously. But there are also so many homages in it to classic Spider-Man stories, whether they're live action, animation, comic books, whatever. There's a nod with the tombstone to the classic Kraven's Last Hunt, mm-hmm. which I'm in the process of reading right now. There's a nod.
And that's just a great character moment. You have a mm-hmm. zombified Tony Stark haunting Peter.
Crawling out of the grave.
Just fantastic. Yeah.
In fact, I halfway thought that we were going to get a Robert Downey Jr. cameo for a moment mm-hmm. there. The scene of him falling into the abyss is reminiscent of any of the clock tower scenes you may have seen with Spider-Man falling, mm-hmm. including from the Sam Raimi films. And it's just a great sequence that stands out in a movie that's got a lot of great action sequences. The stuff with the drones at the end, the big climactic battle sequence with Spider-Man and Mysterio is outstanding. The big illusion at the end where Mysterio almost tricks him the last time, mm. but Peter catches on to it. A rare moment of badassery from this version of Spider-Man. So, yeah, really, really good usage of this character all around. I was extremely impressed from beginning to end.
Yeah, can't say anything more. I mean, it was just an outstanding update on this character. So major props to Marvel and Sony, I suppose, and Jake Gyllenhaal.
Tom Holland gets his starring role back as Peter Parker, and to me, he's really settled into the role now. He's had Civil War, Homecoming, and the two Avengers Infinity movies to play this character before our very eyes, and is really growing into his own. There's still some things that I haven't seen from him yet that I want to see. Like, I want to see him be able to step up and convincingly be the badass Peter Parker, which we haven't had a chance to really see yet. But I think that can come in time as he matures into the role, now that he has a better idea of his identity, now that he's kind of accepting his responsibility as Iron Man's replacement in the MCU. So I think we're going to see that moving forward. But he's great here. He's convincing in his mourning. He's convincing in his humor. He's convincing, especially in his sort of feeling the weight of the world on his shoulders, which is a very Peter Parker thing. Interestingly, though, Nick, it is kind of funny that he's not yet become that wisecracking Spider-Man, I think, that we maybe expect to see in the future. He's not that yet, but that's because of all of these terrible things that have happened to him at such a young age.
Yeah, and most importantly, being you know that my inspirations are what they are, the number one thing I'm always looking for out of a Peter Parker is an awkward romantic encounter. I am looking for someone who has zero game whatsoever and makes you is somewhat endearing in that respect, and I have to say, pulls it off expertly in this one. Homecoming was pretty good. This one was even better in that regard. That's one of the things one of my things on my checklist that he checked off to great satisfaction this time.
Yes, yes. The wisecracks will come, hopefully. But right now we've got that awkwardness. We've got that Parker luck, so to speak. Things just don't seem to go right with him. And I guess, well, before we get to that romantic relationship, I did want to mention something that I just learned. That there's a character. So this movie, we talked about it. Nick talked about it being an inverse of the story of Homecoming in some ways. It's also a mirror image in a lot of ways of Iron Man. Mm-hmm. 2008's Iron Man. This story tells a lot of the beats of that movie, of a character coming into his own, but doing it almost in a reverse fashion, as we'll talk about with the big twist at the end. But one of the characters that returns from that Iron Man movie is a very minor character who worked for Obadiah Stane, Nick's favorite villain in the MCU. And this character is William Ginter Riva. This character, his role is reprised, and I just learned, Nick, that the actor who plays this character is none other than Peter Billingsley of A Christmas Story.
Yep.
I had no idea. He doesn't even look like him, like that character.
No, that's
Ralphie.
Him. Yep.
Amazing. Anyway, Zendaya returns as MJ, a character that we were both quite critical of in Homecoming. And, by the way, I stand by that criticism. I thought she was essentially playing Judd Nelson in The Breakfast Club. But she's back here and, to me, does a much better job. And, in her defense from the first movie, she's given more of a character here. In the first movie, she's playing a stereotype. She's playing a cliche.
She's there for jokes and jokes alone in the first movie. Here, she actually has an arc. She has scenes of which she is the focus. And, as you said, a character and character development. So, as critical as we were, and deservedly so, I think, of the character in Homecoming, I think perhaps this is more indicative of what the character will be going forward. And while it is still not my preferred take on an MJ character, at least this one is getting me to the point of like, okay, I can accept this as well.
Yeah, I liked, much to my surprise, I liked their relationship in this movie. I thought it was believable. I thought I bought it. I bought that they would be attracted to each other. I bought that they would be awkward around each other. I love the fact that she was just as awkward as him.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciated that. You know, so I did like it. You know, it may never be the version of MJ that maybe I have in my head or that I used to from the comics, but in some ways, maybe it'll be better because I never really liked MJ in the comics. So
my lord.
So you know, it's. I think that there are elements of her personality that aren't like any version of MJ we've encountered. But in this movie, we started to see why she acts like that. We started to see that it's a defense mechanism. And I think that, you know, there's room to grow with this relationship. I thought it was really good. And Zendaya did an excellent job. She was given a chance to really play a character in this movie, which I think was a big step up. Once again, Jacob Batalon is playing Ned Leeds.
On the topic of relationships, we gotta hit this.
A character that I will never like. I've decided. I just don't think it'll ever happen. I didn't like him.
He's your Luis.
Yes, he is my Luis at this point. A reference to the Ant-Man movies. For those who don't know, he's here. He's Peter's best friend, but he's here seemingly to me anyway. It felt like a lot less than he is in Homecoming.
I think that's true. He is definitely here a lot less than he is in Homecoming,
and
which I'm kind of thinking is another intentional move on the part of the writers, because Peter is already feeling increasingly isolated, and now his best friend is off with this newfound romance, and he feels even more isolated. So it's just another brick in the wall, so to speak, of Peter's depression and isolation, which is right up my alley, as you know.
Yes, yes. And then they're going to be doing Dark Side of the Moon after that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yes, Ned is a character is not going to work for me on any level, I don't think. But that being said, to quote Gorilla Monsoon at WrestleMania 5 after Run DMC's performance, a little bit of that goes a long way. And so in this movie, they kept him short and sweet. They gave him a pretty hilarious and pretty perfect summer high school fling with Betty Brant, played by Angouri Rice, who I only know from the movie The Nice Guys. Mm-hmm. And she's back as Betty Brant in this one. She was in the first one as well, but not very much. She has a bigger role in this one, and she and Ned have a summer fling, and it's funny, and it ends it ends as many of those do, seemingly. So it was very well executed. Ned does have some good lines in this one. I did chuckle at some of his lines in this one. So even though I say that the character doesn't work for me, in this movie he did have some good stuff, so it wasn't all bad. And they kept that to a low level. And Kobe Smulders is here as Maria Hill, but doesn't get to do very much. Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury is excellent.
Yes,
throughout this movie. And I wouldn't have said that if not for the post-credit scene. We'll get to that in a moment, because there are moments in this movie where you're like, Nick Fury would never say that. And then you realize that was intentional, which at the time it didn't seem. But he's so entertaining. Like one of my favorite Nick Fury scene in the movie, they're standing in the opera house. MJ says, would you like me to go get the opera glasses or whatever the hell? And Peter said, and at the same time, Nick Fury in Peter's earpiece goes, are you in position yet? And Peter says no, which MJ thinks he's saying no to her. And she's like, okay. And then all you hear in the background is Nick Fury going, well, why the hell not?
Mine is one that was in the trailer. It's still, bitch, please, you've been to space. Outstanding.
You just like it because it sounds like a Chappelle line.
No, it sounds like
it
sounds like a Samuel L. Jackson line, like, you know, something that he would have said in his 90s films or whatever. And also the other thing I really liked here, I liked it, even knowing now after the fact that it, as we'll discuss, isn't to be taken at face value. But that those scenes where Nick Fury is coming down on Peter for not being the person he needs to be, for not stepping up in those moments, is straight out of the Nick Fury, like, Peter Parker dynamic from the Ultimate Universe. So that...
And see, that's interesting, because those were some of the scenes that stood out to me as not being in step with the Nick Fury that we've grown to know in the MCU. Because I think the MCU, in a lot of ways, has been telling the evolution of Nick Fury from being that kind of guy to being a more open-minded kind of individual.
That's true, but in the Ultimate Universe, Nick Fury is kind of trying to be, you know, a mentor figure, but given he's the tough love guy. Like, Peter is in the Ultimate Universe develops a relationship with Captain America, who is kind of the good cop to Nick Fury's bad cop, and Fury is never afraid to tell Peter his shortcomings or his limitations or, you know, what the future holds for him. And so that I appreciated, because it spoke to a very specific, like, incarnation of the dynamic that I have an attachment to.
And in addition to that, John Favreau sort of takes over Robert Downey Jr.'s role in this movie, as we see Happy Hogan in this movie a lot more than we've seen him in any MCU movie since Iron Man 2. I think that's correct. Was he in Iron Man 3 a lot? I don't remember.
He got blown up in Iron Man 3. Remember? He
that's right.
Chinese theater.
Chinese.
So yeah, I would say he's probably in this one. He's in this one more than he's been in any film that wasn't an Iron Man film.
Wasn't an Iron Man movie, absolutely. And he is here a lot, partially because he's looking out for Peter, because that was one of Tony's dying wishes, was that Peter would take over for him. And he has left a lot of technology for Pete to use. But he's also here because he is in the process of his own wooing. Much like the nature boy Ric Flair has found love late in his life with the illustrious Wendy, Happy Hogan appears to have found, well, some level of love with Peter's Aunt May. And good for you, Happy Hogan, if that is the case. Although she doesn't seem to be quite as committed to the relationship as he does. But nonetheless, I thought this was a delightful subplot of Happy trying to woo her while also not trying to make it obvious to Peter that he's trying to woo his aunt. So I enjoyed that. What about you, Nick?
I enjoyed it as well. That particular dynamic is fantastic. It leads for, it lends itself to some good comedic moments. It gives Marissa Tomei a little bit more to do than she did in Homecoming, because in Homecoming, she didn't really have a subplot. She was just kind of there to talk to Peter periodically. Here, she kind of has this little happy, you know, subplot that's going on. And man, can she wear the hell out of those mom jeans? That's all I'll say.
No doubt.
But Jon Favreau, in addition to the comedic moments, man, I told you this offline and I stand by it. I now want like a montage. One of the things I want to see going forward in the MCU is people doing things that remind Happy Hogan of Tony and him just like looking wistfully at it, because near the end of the film, there's a plane sequence or a sequence aboard a Stark Industries plane where Happy is kind of giving Peter a pep talk and reveals that there's a lab on board the plane that has all the things Peter needs to build a new suit. And you get this shot of Happy kind of standing in the cockpit and looking back at Peter working in his lab, much the same way that Tony would have.
Yeah, doing like, that Marvel technology where he's pulling things from the air and swapping places and all
and
that stuff.
And just the look on Favreau's face, much like the look on his face in Endgame when Tony's daughter asks for cheeseburgers, it's wordless. He doesn't have to say anything. He is just selling it with his facial expression. It made me choke up. Like, it is legitimately, that plane sequence in a movie that is filled with lightheartedness and humor reminds you of emotional weight, and it had me. It had me in the palm of its hand in that sequence.
I too enjoyed the scene. I thought it was a good scene, and liked seeing Favreau in this movie. I hope he pops up more in the future. It's also nice to see the Happy Hogan character not worrying about putting up an illusion anymore, because for so long he, hence his ironic name, for so long he put on this air of this stoic tough guy that was always, you know, hated to be in whatever situation he was in. And here we see how much Tony's death has affected him, because he's no longer worried about putting up an illusion or pretending to be some tough guy that doesn't feel emotions. He's pretty much wearing his heart on his sleeve now, and he's out to help people. And he does that here. He helps Peter's friends out when they're in a jam. So really good performance from Favreau, really good stuff all around there. And I guess we got to touch on the sort of elephant in the room, which is the two post-credit scenes.
Yeah.
The mid-credit scene and the post-credit scene. So the story wraps up, as you might expect. Spider-Man wins. He gets the girl. He and MJ are together. She knows his identity now. So that now leaves, as of the end of the official movie, who all knows his identity? May.
May, Happy,
all the Avengers,
Gwyneth Paltrow, you would assume, yeah, all
yes,
the
Pepper Potts,
all the characters Avengers. From Endgame, essentially,
yeah,
and then Ned, and MJ, yeah,
and of course Nick Fury and all those folks,
all the Mysterio team as well. That's one thing we didn't really mention is that Mysterio, yes, as much as it is Jake Gyllenhaal, is really a team of individuals, of ex-Stark employees, mm-hmm, a team of 12 to 15 people who presumably all survived this film, and thus all know Peter Parker as Spider-Man.
All know Peter Parker's identity. And the Vulture also knows Peter Parker's identity.
He does, that's right.
So essentially a shitload of people, as many people know Spider-Man's identity,
which
as know the Flash's identity.
Is another thing that I love, because it's in keeping with the Ultimate Universe. There's a scene in an Ultimate comic at one point where Peter and MJ are just hanging out together in Peter's basement, and she pulls out a notepad, and she's like, we should really make a list, and they just start writing down all the people who know the secret identity, and it gets to be like three columns long, and she's like, I think this is kind of a problem, don't you? Good stuff.
Yeah, which I think they may have homaged on The Flash at one point, because somebody asks I remember there was an episode, maybe in like season three, where Cisco asked the Flash, "Is there anyone in this city that doesn't know your identity at this point?" And the answer is no. So anyway, the mid-credit scene here, we'll talk about two different things, because the mid-credit scene to me is the big one.
They're both big in their own different ways, right?
And what the last scene, in some ways, makes you view the movie in a different way. Mid-credit scene going forward is the one that's going to have, I think, the biggest value. Well, you could argue that too, I guess. But basically, Spidey takes MJ swinging through the city, as you may have seen in the Raimi movies. She's not impressed. She's not happy with that. Doesn't want to do it anymore. And flies off. And then there is a breaking news announcement that plays in Times Square. And Spider-Man perches on a light post to watch it. And we are introduced to J. Jonah Jameson. Played,
yes.
Huge spoiler alert here, guys. Again, if you've gotten this far, we spoiled a lot of shit already, but this is a big one. So stop listening if you haven't seen the movie yet. All right. So we meet J. Jonah Jameson, played by J.K. Simmons from the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films, reprising his role.
And I literally screamed out loud when that happened.
Like, yes. Nick told me on the phone that he made the Rocky Johnson at the Hall of Fame noise.
Yes, the
or the Jerry Lawler on every Raw in 1998 noise.
Yeah, a little bit louder. I mean, and more prolonged than that. Like, all the people in front of me had no idea why I was so excited. But, you know, it's simple. I know it's just a casting for what was essentially a glorified cameo. But you and I and people in our friends group and our inner circle have talked about for years. To me, it's just like, you know, The Lion King is coming out later this year, the live-action remake, Greg. And they're doing something brilliant in my estimation, which is James Earl Jones is still alive. Why let anyone else do that Mufasa role besides James Earl Jones? And to me, the J. Jonah Jameson performance that J.K. Simmons gave in those Raimi Spider-Man movies was character defining. Like,
yes.
And not in terms of, like, I mean, Heath Ledger's Joker is character defining, but it's almost like creating its own version of the character, right? J.K. Simmons, J. Jonah Jameson, is the closest thing I can imagine to literally the comic character just walking off the page and onto the screen. It is pitch perfect, and I never want to see anyone else play that character as long as he's alive.
Mm-hmm. One of the under-talked about great casting moments in comic book movie history.
And arguably the best casting decision of those Raimi Spider-Man films, I would
mm-hmm.
put forth.
Yeah, that and perhaps Molina.
A performance so good that, like, really, if you're talking about the most essential Spider-Man characters, J. Jonah Jameson is pretty high up there for an incarnation, I would argue. And yet, it took three films across two entire franchises for anyone to even feel comfortable attempting it again. So defining was that J.K. Simmons interpretation. And Marvel and Sony, in their infinite wisdom, rather than trying to reinvent the wheel and trying to top something that cannot be topped, they just got J.K. Simmons to play this new version.
If it ain't broke, why fix it?
And the brilliant thing here is...
Hey, wait. Let me get to there. You know about the reinvention?
Yes.
Yes. So we're sitting in the theater watching it. I watched the movie with David Sunday of the Sunday Groove podcast, which you can catch right here at Place to Be Nation Pop. And we were watching the film, and I told him this after the movie ended, and it sounds self-glorifying in retrospect, but it's a thing that actually happened. So I'm sitting there during a kind of downtime moment in the second half of the movie, and I'm thinking to myself what the big surprise could be, because the only thing that I had spoiled for the movie was that there was a big surprise in the post-credit scene. And so I was thinking to myself, what could this surprise be? I didn't think it was going to be anything as outlandish as what we were speculating at work that, well, gosh, maybe Tobey Maguire shows up. There's a multiverse. Maybe the end of the Spider-Verse plays in somehow. But I was thinking, what could it be? And I said, maybe it's J. Jonah Jameson. It probably won't be J.K. Simmons, but wouldn't that be cool? And then I started thinking about it. I was like, it really doesn't make sense. And they've had no indication in these movies that Peter Parker is interested in photography or interested in newspapers. And it really, and this is from a former newspaper man, would not make any sense to me for a kid of Peter Parker's intelligence and sophistication and all that stuff to even want to go into newspaper photography in 2019. I mean, newspapers being in the state that they are right now, I think it makes sense for Superman as a character to still want to become a reporter because of who he is and what that means to him. Peter Parker, as someone who's going to be struggling to pay bills and who has to concern himself with that stuff, it doesn't make any sense to me. So I was like, how are they going to update J. Jonah Jameson? And I thought to myself, Daily Bugle kind of sounds like one of those online news rags, like the Daily Beast or something, which is exactly what I thought about, the Daily Beast or something. I was like, what if they reimagine him as one of these like people that runs an online news site that is extremely partisan, that is extremely biased, that doesn't really vet its sources and things like that. And sure enough, this version of J. Jonah Jameson is an Alex Jones type figure hosting a clear take on InfoWars as he proclaims to the world that Spider-Man is a menace and that
Mysterio is the greatest hero
who has ever lived. Which sounds like a Norm Macdonald bit, but is a true line from J. Jonah here. And he plays a clip that Mysterio, put in quotes, which is actually the people that worked with Quentin Beck, send in, which is an altered illusion from Beck showing Spider-Man ordering these drone attacks on civilians, mowing down hundreds of civilians in London. And now the world believes that Spider-Man is a villain, that Spider-Man has gone rogue. And as Peter's watching this, J. Jonah Jameson drops yet another bombshell and reveals to the world that Spider-Man's real identity is Peter Parker, a teenager in Queens, New York. So, bam! It's an inverted Iron Man 1 moment, where at the end of Iron Man 1, legendary Spurs player Tony Parker calls a press conference announcing to the world that he is indeed Iron Man, and he's now a worldwide celebrity, loved the world over. Here, Spider-Man's identity is revealed against his will to the public, and now he's enemy number one across the globe. Mm-hmm. Brilliant.
Which is
brilliant, like, mirror image from Marvel Comics.
And fits perfectly into tons of Spider-Man stories from over the years where public sentiment is against him. And, like, it affects him because he cares so much that I can't wait to see how they handle this going forward. You and I are... Don't get me wrong. I would like to see them develop this over multiple films, but I believe we're going to get like a movie out of this, and they'll find a way out of it, personally.
Well, it'll be very easy. It'll be very easy because of the post-credit scene. So the post-credit scene is Nick Fury and Maria Hill are driving their car, and both of them shift into Skrulls. Now, they are the familiar Skrulls, Talos and Sorin from Captain Marvel that we met a few months ago. Interesting reaction in the theater to this scene, though, Nick, because there were clearly several people watching this Spider-Man movie that have not seen Captain Marvel. Oh. And so they gasped audibly when this happened and were like, oh, because they were thinking that these were aliens that had been impersonating Nick Fury and that these aliens had taken over the world, basically, and were impersonating all these characters. But in fact, we know these Skrulls are good guys. So Talos and Sorin have been playing the roles of Nick Fury and Maria Hill the entire movie. And that's why Nick Fury delivers weird lines like, do not invoke her name with regards to Captain Marvel, because Captain Marvel is responsible for saving the Skrull people. So Talos, impersonating Nick Fury, delivers a line that Nick Fury would never say in a million years, do not invoke her name. So it's a great scene that ties the whole movie together, makes it believable, because the one thing that wasn't working for me about Mysterio, Nick, was I did not buy that Nick Fury would buy Mysterio's lies. I bought that Spider-Man would, but Nick Fury, the most paranoid MF-er in the MCU, I just didn't believe that. And this makes it make sense, because we find out that Nick Fury is off in deep space commanding a Skrull spaceship at the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. So because of this, they could easily have one of the Skrulls impersonate Peter Parker and prove that he and Spider-Man are not the same person. That being said, Nick, I hope they don't. I believe there is a lot of story to tell. We have seen public identities throughout the MCU. I would argue that that's because in 2019, secret identities don't make a lot of sense. And I would argue that it's also been different because, yes, Tony Stark reveals his identity and wears a mask afterwards regardless as protection. However, Tony Stark didn't have a family to provide for. He was a bachelor. He didn't have people to worry about close to him other than Pepper. Captain America, same story. Everybody knows he's Steve Rogers, but he doesn't have a family. Peter Parker has his aunt. He has his girlfriend and his friends at school to worry about. There's a lot of people that could get hurt, potentially, with his identity public. There is also the element of the Vulture, who's been keeping his identity a secret this whole time, how he'll react to it. I just think there's a lot of story to tell. And admittedly, Nick, part of that is because I feel like Marvel Comics chickened out of telling that story when it was very, very compelling, and they could have gotten years of storytelling out of Spider-Man's identity going public. I didn't like that they went back on it. Now, most likely, you're correct that we'll get one movie out of this, maybe two, and then it will go back to the status quo, and that's fine. Certainly, you can tell stories with the secret identity, but gosh, it's just, unless you have the speed of the Flash or Superman, it's awful hard to convincingly pull off a secret identity these days. We even talked about it on Arrow in the early seasons with the little spirit mask, how that was going to conceal his identity. Overall, I thought it was both of these post-credit scenes were great, and that mid-credit scene in particular is one of my favorite ones they've ever done.
Yeah, loved them both. In the dual post-credit scene era where we get multiple ones, this might be the best 1-2 punch that we've seen. I mean, just two really, really great credit scenes. So loved them both and thrilled beyond belief to see where both the Spider-Man franchise and the MCU goes from here after these two credit scenes.
Absolutely. And we both love the movie. But let's talk about where it ranks in the Spider-Man pantheon. Now, you've had two viewings. I've only had one. So this is after one initial riding high viewing of this movie. We're going to rewatch another movie that I have been alternatingly critical of over the years, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 1, here next week. But before we get to that, let's talk about where this movie, as of now, with the understanding that this could change next week, would sit in our Spider-Man movie rankings. Nick, why don't you kick things off?
I would have it second.
So let's hear those rankings.
Oh, God. I didn't come prepared.
I didn't either.
How many are there? Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. Are we doing...
We're counting Spider-Verse.
I was about to say, are we doing the actual version of the list, or are we doing the Russell Sellers version of the list? I was just curious.
Let's do both.
Let's do... Wait, what? I'm so confused now. How many rankings of what movies am I giving you?
You're giving me... Well, let's include Spider-Verse.
Okay.
And with the understanding that if you take it out, the bottom movie below it will move up. So.
Okay, so there are eight then, is what we're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Eighth is clearly The Amazing Spider-Man 2. And anyone who dares to put Spider-Man 3 at that spot has not recently seen The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Let me reiterate that. I have watched both those movies within the last calendar year. It's not even close, man. Not even close.
Yes, Amazing Spider-Man 2, as Russell put it, is in a – there is a cavernous gap between that and the 7 spot.
Right. So that would be 8. 7 would be Spider-Man 3. 6 would be Spider-Man. 5. Oh, here we go. Here's where I catch the heat. 5 would be Spider-Man 2, and let me explain.
Sweet Jesus.
Greg, I've had this opinion for a long time. You act like it's not like I've had
my Spider-Man Rogues Gallery opinions for a long time. You still did your
Let me explain. Spider-Man is probably the character to which I am most emotionally attached. Like, it was the first comic I ever read regularly was Ultimate Spider-Man. It's responsible for, you know, me being interested in comics is responsible for that entire side of my personality and my interests. It's, you know, arguably responsible for that aspect of not just our friendships, but other friendships I've formed. It kind of was the thing that got me started. And as a result, I have this deep personal emotional attachment to a very specific incarnation of Spider-Man, which is one that isn't really portrayed in the Raimi films. And I still enjoy those films, by the way. Like, I honestly believe, like, Amazing Spider-Man 2 is a god-awful film. Spider-Man 3 is a below-average film. And the rest of the films, to me, are really good. So I'm not saying that I don't like Spider-Man 2. I like it a lot. I think it's a great film. I'm just saying, for me personally, in terms of emotional impact, I'm going to put it at 5. I'm going to put The Amazing Spider-Man at 4. And I understand that's controversial, but my love for that film has never wavered from the first time I saw it. And subsequent rewatches over the years, I still love.
This is like those lists that had Logan at 4 or 5.
I understand. I get it. I would put Homecoming at 3. I would put Far From Home at 2. And I would put Into the Spider-Verse at 1.
Very good. Very good. I echo the bottom of your list, certainly, with Amazing Spider-Man 2 at 8. And then somewhere hovering in the stratosphere above it at number 7 is Spider-Man 3. And then I would have Amazing Spider-Man at the number 6 spot. At number 5, herein lies the rub. This is what could change next week, potentially. At number 5, I have Spider-Man. At number 4, I have Spider-Man Homecoming. At number 3, I have Spider-Man Far From Home, although I feel like having them at 3 and 4 doesn't express how much better I thought Far From Home was than Homecoming, because it's really, really good and not far off the top 2. Number 2, I have Into the Spider-Verse, and at number 1, I have Spider-Man 2. And again, these rankings could change slightly next week depending on how I feel about Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go.
And you, Nick, you have actually updated your MCU rankings, and I have not, so I'm just going to cede the floor to you.
Oh, my God. You're going to make me do this and not even attempt it. Do I have to do the whole thing, or can I just
You can just say where it slots in.
Yeah, so first viewing, I had it right behind Homecoming, and then after watching it the second time, I moved it ahead of Homecoming. Essentially. So let's see. I have it at number 6 in the MCU right now.
Wow. Very good.
Well, I had Homecoming at 6 coming in. So, I mean, that's just, True. You know, that speaks to where you give me a high school Spider-Man who is being emotionally impacted by relationships. And it speaks to what I want from this character. So, yeah, right there. 6.
Yeah, I can't even find our old rankings right now. So
you had Homecoming at, let's see, you had Homecoming at 22, 21. So you had Homecoming at 16.
16. This one, I would, without looking at the rest of the movies.
You had Captain Marvel at 15.
This was better than Captain Marvel.
You had Ant-Man and the Wasp at 14.
This was better than Ant-Man and the Wasp.
You had Iron Man at 13.
I need to revisit. I think this that feels about right for this one, in that 12 to 13 sort of position for me, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm gonna stick with that for now, and if I can find the list before the end of the night, I'll try to give that a little bit more thought. Again, only one viewing thus far. Mm-hmm. But if that being said, folks, we want to hear your thoughts on Spider-Man Far From Home. Give us a shout out on Twitter at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Once again, if you have any complaints about the show, you can address those to at jrsbbq. You can drop us an email at the loneliest email addresses on the internet, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. Join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Just go to Facebook, search for Place to Be Nation Comics, join the discussion. We'll talk about Far From Home with you. We won't have any public spoiler discussions yet, but we can certainly set up one of Nick's favorite things, a private Facebook group chat to discuss these things. And we can make that be a thing. So with that being said, folks, we are going to take a break. When we come back on the other side, we have got reading, watching, the rundown, the wrestling minute, and everything under the sun.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Greg and Nick back with you here. And boy, we've got a lot of interesting and exciting action going on here at PlaceToBeNation.com. And in particular, on our pop feed. It's so busy you wouldn't believe it. In our newest Marvel Age podcast, The Sarcastic Four, of which Nick is one, dive into 1971.
Mm-hmm.
A year of great music, great movies, and good comics. Maybe even great comics, Nick. With the first of three parts covering the year 1971. The eighth episode of Laugh in Theater has Andy welcoming me, Greg Phillips, to watch one of the funniest movies of all time, Austin Powers International Man of Mystery. Good time there to be had with Andy. Also, the hard-traveling fanboys, that's us, have kicked off Spider-Man Month. That's right, Spider-Man Month is continuing as you listen to this show. DC4U, the newest weekly comic show on the pop feed, is Russell and Todd bringing us monthly current events in the DC Comics world for June 2019. And actually, they've moved beyond that now. They're giving you the newest episode is all about Superman, featuring Stephen Joseph Ferrari, as they're talking about the best stories and characters in the world of the Man of Steel. Songs with Friends, episode 29, features Kenny Chesney's The Good Stuff and Fuel's Shimmer. I know, curious to see how they'll dissect the lyrics of The Good Stuff. Geek and Sassy welcome Tim Capel to recap season 2. Preview season 3 of Stranger Things on Netflix, of course. Join Glenn and Scott as they discuss and debate the Democratic hopefuls for the coming presidential election in a new spectacular. Mm-hmm. And on a new episode of the NBA team, Adam Murray and Andrew Reich are here to reflect on what has been quite the last week in NBA land as the tides have shifted in the landscape of power in the NBA. The greatest song of the 80s tournament, meanwhile, continues.
Mm.
There will be 6 polls a day posted for round 1. 6 polls a day, Nick. When's the last time you had 6 polls in one day?
6 polls a day of 2 songs per poll, 12 songs, and none of them will ever, you know, pull from the very deep library of 1980s country music, because this tournament is run by our terroristic northern overlords.
Absolutely. This is a musical war of northern aggression.
Absolutely.
Nonetheless, vote. Go to Fate of the Furious for some reason. Mm-hmm. Go to Facebook by searching PTBN's greatest song of the 80s tournament and liking the page. Vote there. Vote on Twitter at the Place to Be Nation Twitter account. Vote twice. That's what I do. And try to make sure that your song has a fighting chance. Nick, what's going on in the world of wrestling?
Well, over on the PTBN wrestling feed, on the Place to Be podcast, Justin Scott and Steve Bennett are back inside the home office for a dive into the 9:30/89 Madison Square Garden house show. Gotta love those MSG house shows. JT and Chad open up the 1996 pay-per-view year with a look at the Royal Rumble on the latest Wrestling Warzone. Place to Be Nation staff members Jennifer Smith, Drew Wardlow, and Matt Souza gather to break down the 1986 Crockett Cup. In the 10th episode of Row 1, Seat 1, Ben welcomes documentary filmmaker and wrestling superfan John Filipovich to the podcast.
I believe you mean John Filipovich.
Whatever. On episode 129 of Main Event, Scott, Nate, and Steve previewed AEW's Fighter Fest, Ring of Honor's Best in the World, and recap some classic TNA from 2002. Meanwhile, over on PlaceToBeNation.com, our tribute to 1994 is off and running with pieces on the Best Picture nominees from that year, the 1994 World Cup, and the miniseries The Stand. Also, Excellent Network Adventure Team is back with a look at ECW One Night Stand 2006. And be sure to check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE PPV and TV Match Ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list.
Very good. Very good, Nick. And now it's time for our weekly look at the PN news and notes in the world of comics. It's a segment that we like to call
Welcome to the Rundown. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown. Where we talk about movies too.
Boy, another loaded deck here for us, Nick. But there was only one way for us to start. And that's to start with what originally buttered our bacon, or breaded our butter, or something, which is the world of print comics, because a huge news announcement came out this past week, Nick.
It did indeed. And that is as much grief as we've given this particular book, it is without a doubt a seismic announcement in the landscape of comics.
And the link is not the story about that happening. But nonetheless, let's see what I can find here. Once my computer cooperates. Yes, a very surprise thing happened as just a couple days before it released to shelf, people found out that AMC's, that Image Comics' The Walking Dead will be ending with this past week's issue, number 193. That's right, 193 issues of The Walking Dead by Robert Kirkman, and it has come to its end. It has reached its conclusion. I'm not sure how. I haven't read the book, obviously, but AMC assures fans that the shows will continue going, but the comic book has come to an end. What a historic run here, and like you said, Nick, I am no big fan of this series. We've been over it during Walking Dead month the last few years.
And we'll be again this year.
Exactly. We'll be again this year. I am not a big fan of this comic book. I don't think it's very well written. However, my subjective opinions of the comic book aside, there is no getting around the fact that this is a tremendous achievement, an independent comic book that I know many people have said online in some ways saved the comic book industry. At a time when it was dying on the vine, The Walking Dead came along and paved the way for independent creator-owned comics to be able to not just succeed in the marketplace, but in some ways to, in the cases of books like Saga, to dominate the marketplace in the trade paperback realm. So The Walking Dead was a book that ended up printing money for Image Comics and allowed it to support the kinds of stories that we now associate with Image Comics, from your Ed Brubakers, from your Brian K. Vaughn's, from your Brian Michael Bendis, or whoever you might find that might pop up in the Image realm. It's just a remarkable achievement. Regardless of our thoughts on the quality of the book, it's outstanding that Kirkman has made it to 193, and certainly this is a momentous occasion in the world of comics, and no doubt is also going to make a mark in the speculator market too. So, what are your thoughts on this book coming to an end, Nick?
Yeah, like we said, momentous announcement. I do think it's – as much as I, you know, have my issues with Kirkman and the hype that has been given towards this comic in recent years, I do think going out in this fashion is kind of cool, actually. Rather than doing this big, giant build-up to it, Walking Dead, according to its fans anyway, is a book that is best when it's defying expectations. So no better way to end than to defy expectations and shock people one last time. So pretty cool thing they were able to pull off. I'm just stunned that it didn't leak sooner. Like, I would have thought this would have, you know, that somebody would have leaked this, you know, weeks, months ago even. But no, They kept it all the way to the end. Good for them.
Well, the second most surprising announcement in the world of comics from this past week came from the world of television. And that is that, kind of out of nowhere, Netflix has optioned DC's The Sandman by Neil Gaiman as a live-action show. Alan Heinberg has signed on as the showrunner and chief writer, with Neil Gaiman and David S. Goyer on board as executive producers. This show will follow Netflix taking over Fox's Lucifer, which itself was a spinoff of the Sandman comic book series. I'm assuming they probably won't be tied in.
Yeah. What very little I know about Lucifer, the TV show, I have a hard time imagining it will tie into Sandman.
So the Hollywood Reporter says that this will be DC's, quote, most expensive TV foray ever, and also one that DC's sister company, HBO, passed on.
That was my first thing, because as we have another story on our rundown that we'll talk about in a little bit. I was kind of surprised that Netflix got this at first, because I knew that there were so many things over at Warner Brothers pushes for original high-profile content that this would have been a perfect fit. So I'm still a little – shocked, honestly, that
– I'm guessing the price tag is what led to the led to HBO passing.
But HBO shows are not exactly cheap. Like, you know,
no, but they've also got a slate, and I think they're banking on Watchmen being a big hit. I think they're banking on these Game of Thrones spinoffs being hits. Who knows if they
West
will
Westworld
be.
Is coming back at some point.
Westworld, right? So
I think
maybe
after
they
the
just
response to True Detective season 3, you're probably getting another season of that. God knows when.
And I also think Netflix was probably willing to bid at a high level, because I think Netflix knows that it's about to have to ramp up its own content because of
some of
the announcements that are coming.
It's just interesting from the standpoint of Warner Brothers, of if you're about to get into this streaming service game, why would you want to license one of your properties to a competitor who is going to be – like, you know, the competition for our dollar as consumers – you know, for each of these services to get us to subscribe is going to be greater and greater in the coming years. So it was a little bit surprising to me that Warner would seemingly give Netflix one of the bullets that they could have put into their own gun. But that's taking away from the fact that I've never read Sandman. I know it's one of our giant blind spots. Greg and I will probably try to correct that for this podcast at some point, at least some of, you know, maybe the initial volumes or whatever or what have you. But given what I know about it, it's kind of like Watchmen, in that it's the way it's been described to me. I've always kind of heard that people consider it to be unfilmable, or at the very least, very difficult. It would be very difficult to adapt. So this is intriguing for sure. And most people that I talk to online or that I read the opinions of seem to be very excited that this is going to be a television series as opposed to a movie.
Yes. And I think we generally tend to feel that way about adaptations of these sort of epic comic books, right? Mm-hmm. Very rarely have we – Watchmen kind of being maybe an exception, but very rarely have we run into one of these where we're like, you know what? A Why the Last Man movie would probably be better than a show, you know, just because of the long, sweeping nature of some of these stories. Preacher. You could not do Preacher in a movie, at least one movie. So – but it's funny you mention all that, Nick, because it does tie in to our next item on the list, which is Warner Media announcing its much ballyhooed new streaming service titled, somewhat curiously, HBO Max, which will stream content from across Warner's media platforms, including DC, Cartoon Network, HBO, and more. according to Variety. The service will feature notable television shows, including The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Friends, which will leave Netflix for HBO Max when the service launches in 2020. And it will launch with 10,000 hours of content at launch, drawing from Warner Brothers, New Line, DC Entertainment, CNN, TNT, TBS, True TV, The CW, Turner Classic Movies, Cartoon Network, Adult Swim, Crunchyroll, Rooster Teeth, and Looney Tunes.
Crunchyroll is an anime streaming service that Warner Brothers owns. So that
what is Rooster Teeth?
Rooster
Please
Teeth.
Please tell me.
Okay, Rooster Teeth. Let me make sure I'm getting this right before I say it. But do you remember the old red versus blue Halo internet videos?
Yes.
Rooster Teeth is the company that is responsible for creating those. They did Red versus Blue.
Ah.
They've done other video game themed properties, comedy properties since then. And they've been around for about 15 years now since that Red versus Blue started. They've kind of spun off into a more mainstream quote comedy platform. I think they just had a live action show that I can't remember the name of that got picked up somewhere. So started off as a very niche product and have kind of expanded, but Crunchyroll is very niche as well. So, I mean, I guess the idea is that they're kind of trying to provide something for everyone here with this HBO Max streaming service.
Well, HBO Max will also be the exclusive streaming home of CW's upcoming series Batwoman, mm-hmm, and the Riverdale spinoff Katie Keene. Mm-hmm. And Greg Berlanti has signed on to produce 4 young adult movies for the service.
And after next year, all the CW shows are leaving Netflix and moving over to HBO Max as well.
Indeed so. Here's the interesting aspect of all this, Nick. I don't think any of this is terribly surprising to me, except the title. Because, and I'm not going to steal this without attribution, our buddy Tim Capel brought this up in the chat thread. Now you've already got some marketplace confusion in the form of HBO Go versus HBO Now, mm-hmm, which are different versions of carrying HBO through a streaming service. HBO Go is for those that have a cable service, mm-hmm, with HBO. HBO Now is for those that don't have a cable service with HBO. Presumably, from what we've been told, those services will continue. And yet this is now HBO Max, mm-hmm, even though HBO would seemingly be a relatively, and in comparison, minor aspect of this entire deal when you factor in 10,000 hours of content. Mm-hmm. So it sort of begs the question, why the branding of HBO Max?
My thought on that is HBO Go and Now are both recognized names in the streaming game, right? Like, mm-hmm, HBO Go or Now, I don't know. Let's just pick one to call it. Let's call it HBO Go. I like that one better anyway. HBO Go is something that people, throughout America at least, use by the millions. Game of Thrones this past season was being watched just as much on streaming platforms as it was on traditional HBO. It's something that people get really excited about. It's a service that people use across multiple platforms. It has brand recognition built in. HBO is also come to mean – I mean, think about HBO original programming has become kind of this symbol of quality. So I think you are using the brand recognition of both the pre-existing streaming service and the brand recognition of the quality of HBO programming to suggest to people this isn't something like CBS All Access, for example, where – it launches and there's not a ton of content. It's kind of not worth the price that people were paying for it. This suggests to you, hey, you know what you're getting here. This is a proven commodity. Come subscribe to this, and it's going to give you everything you love from HBO plus all this other stuff.
Indeed so. And certainly a unique situation. One of the interesting things, though, also is in the commercial for this, mm-hmm, they put out. It shows Doom Patrol, which currently is a DC Universe exclusive. What does this mean for DC Universe moving forward?
No one knows. The interesting thing is one of the reports I read said that right now, I believe HBO Now is priced at $14.99 a month, and that this will probably be priced higher than that. So I think it's possible that you could see something like DC Universe or Crunchyroll, which is also a subscription service, continue to exist at that lower, much lower price point. Or you could just go the full Monty, get this HBO Max deal, and get everything that's included on that platforms as well. On those platforms, I should say. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see. Me, personally, I would love to see DC Universe give all of the video content to HBO Max and just dedicate itself as a comic streamer. And then I'll get HBO Max for the other stuff if I want to.
You would want that to happen even at the same price point that you're currently paying for the video and the comics?
What's the price point for DC Universe right now?
It's like
$9.75. Well, what do we pay annually? $75 a year?
Mm-hmm.
Well worth it for a comprehensive comics library. $75
yes,
is well
I agree.
Worth it. No issue.
I agree. But do you feel that the rest of the existing DC Universe fan base would feel the same way?
I don't know, and I don't especially care.
Fair enough. Well, speaking of things that I don't know and don't especially care about,
wait a minute,
Joe Hill.
You didn't comment at all about how you feel about this, because I know you're not thrilled about it.
Well, why do you say I'm not thrilled about it?
I know you. I know your thoughts on streaming technology. And
indeed.
You don't like the way it's moving is the way
I don't. No, I don't like the way it's moving because it's not – here's the thing. It's not going to do any good to complain about it because it's not going to change. It's not going to change anything to sit here and bitch for 30 minutes about, you know, how streaming service is ultimately a long form con that's just turned into exactly the same thing that cable was that got people to cut the cord in the first place. I think that you're going to see a rise in piracy as a result of all of these multiple everybody making everything so niche with streaming, and I think it doesn't do anything to help the people that are the customers. I think the customers suffer ultimately as a result of all of this. But that's how it works.
Yeah.
Corporations control it all. They're gonna find new ways to bleed us of every dollar that we have.
Oh yeah, that's been my thing all along. Is like the cable revenues weren't like that. The big content providers weren't just going to say, well, that revenue's lost and never try to regain it. Like, they were going to figure it out at some point. Like, that was inevitable.
Yep. And it's just going to take it's going to go to different companies, and it's going to filter out in different ways now. And it sucks. There's nothing you can do about it, but it does suck. I do think it's unfortunate. I don't like it at all. But it's just one of those first world problems, right? You know, I don't want to pay this much money for this level of entertainment. And ultimately, you'll end up doing what I've sort of done with the monthly comics trade and found my entertainment elsewhere. So it's going to have to happen at some point. But that being said, we do have another story that doesn't mean a lot to me because I don't know much about the guy, but Joe Hill is writing and overseeing a new line of DC horror comics. He is known as a novelist, and currently his book series Nosferatu has been adapted to AMC, and he's done Lock and Key is his most well-known comic series alongside artist Gabriel Rodriguez. But he is returning to comics with a line of DC horror titles titled Hill House Comics. And Nick, I don't know much about him except he is the son of Stephen King. Is that correct?
Yes. And he
looks like Randy Owen, the lead singer of Alabama.
A little bit. Yeah. And you mentioned he's not just the son of Stephen King. He's got some proven properties that people are very excited
about.
Oh, no,
he's a good, he's a very well-established writer. I didn't mean to
– No,
I was just mentioning
just,
it as biographical info.
Right, right. I think the more exciting aspect of this is kind of what it represents, is that, you know, you and I both questioned the future of original adult-themed content at DC now that Vertigo is gone, and the questions about Black Label's future in the wake of the Batman Damned controversy. I'm certainly not expecting this to be, you know, slasher – torture porn in the pages of printed comics, but this does at least suggest that there is still an avenue for original creations that are aimed at an older audience inside the corporate comics environment. So how will this turn out quality-wise, no idea, but it suggests to me that DC is not throwing the towel entirely on new and exciting and different ways of telling comic book-related stories.
And another indicator of that, Nick, is our next story, which indicates that Hellblazer, yeah, John Constantine, will be leaving the mainstream DC universe, or not leaving, but being sort of transferred back to his roots in DC's what's being called the Sandman Universe titles. He will debut with a one-shot and then an ongoing. He'll make his premiere in October in the Sandman Universe Presents Hellblazer number 1 by Simon Spurrier and artist Marcio Takara, which will induct the character into the Neil Gaiman curated group of titles. The ongoing will be by Spurrier and artist Aaron Campbell beginning in November. Gaiman says he's thrilled to bring the original demon-haunted John Constantine back to his murky and dangerous roots. Pretty exciting stuff here for longtime fans of the Hellblazer, a character that I have to say, Nick, controversially perhaps, never really fit in for me in the mainstream DCU.
I think it depends on the context of the stories he's being used in. I look at something like, what was it, Day of Vengeance, the Infinite Crisis tie-in? Was that the one? Yeah, where he was with Shadow Watch or whatever it was, Detective Chimp and that kind of stuff. That worked for me. And there have been, you know, various other stories here and there that I've enjoyed his usage, but for the most part, anytime they've tried to do like an ongoing where he's a central focus of the DC universe or has a major role to play, yeah, it kind of falls flat. But so this is exciting. Probably won't read it, but this just seems like a more natural fit.
Yes, certainly would agree with that. And exciting times for the character there. So good things coming from the DC creator-friendly line of comics there. Well, one of the books that we've reviewed recently, speaking of creator-led titles, was the X-Men Grand Design book. We talked about that and what a home run it really was in our eyes, sort of condensing the oftentimes convoluted history of the X-Men into an understandable chronological narrative. Well, Marvel is going back to that well, but with a different creator this time and a different group of characters. So X-Men Grand Design just wrapped up, and this time writer and artist Tom Scioli is going to be unveiling Fantastic Four Grand Design. He describes the Fantastic Four as the Magna Carta of Marvel, the founding document. So he is filling in for Ed Piskor, who did this for X-Men, and Scioli plans to try to make the Fantastic Four both make sense and be entertaining for a modern art audience while homaging these classic Jack Kirby and Stan Lee comics from back in the day and going up through the John Byrne era, the Mark Waid era, everything in between. So this will premiere in Fantastic Four Grand Design number 1 of 2. So there's only going to be 2 of these, it looks like.
Well, that was originally the plan for X-Men Grand Design as well, and then it expanded into what was it, Second Genesis, and then what was the last one that we've already
Extinction or something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
Extermination?
Yeah, so this is kind of the same thing. I would imagine there's probably a specific era they're trying to cover with these, and then perhaps more will happen, or they'll just call the next 2 issues something else or what have you. But it's also interesting that they're using the Grand Design naming again, because Grand Design to me implied like evolution and this like the very idea of mutation, and it seemed more native to an X-Men book. I didn't really think of it as the catch-all for the concept, but I guess it works, I suppose.
Yes, I was looking at it more as like the Watcher looking down and explaining the sort of the grand design, so to speak, behind all of these events that happen in these characters' lives and what it all amounts to, what the point of it all is in the end. So we'll see. You know, I'm not a fan of the Fantastic Four, as I've mentioned many times, but that might be a pretty good long book hunters to do at some point down the line. So we'll have to keep an eye on this project.
Absolutely.
The Flash. Where is this link? We have another story coming up, folks. Don't worry about that. That's just me trying to run through our links here. The Flash movie. Let's go. Wait, before I get to this, Nick, let's move over to a corner. Gosh, it's so dusty and murky over here. There's spiders everywhere. But we got to get over to this area of our office here, of our lab, of our studio. That's the word I was looking for. Called the DCEU Corner. Well, here we are, folks, and the Flash movie, believe it or not, is still on life support. It just will not die because the latest set of director and screenwriter have left. John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein, the writing directing duo, they have exited the movie. Ezra Miller remains attached for the lead role. However, Ezra Miller's script that he wrote and finished with Grant Morrison was passed over by the studio, according to The Hollywood Reporter. Now the studio has courted director Andy Muschietti and screenwriter Christina Hodson, who are now in talks to take over The Flash. Hodson has experience writing Birds of Prey and The Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, a movie that has not been released yet, but apparently the studio is already high on. So before we get any further into this, Nick, do we actually think this is the one that's going to stick? Nope. Is this the team that's going to stick on this one? Yeah, I didn't think so either.
And I you know, you hate to pull for people to fail, but I hope it fails because each failure gets us closer to them just throwing their hands up and Ezra Miller moving on, which is
my God.
The thing
well,
I
that's
want
the, that
most.
Is the part of this story that was the most disturbing to me is that Ezra Miller is still attached because I just don't want it.
I don't want it,
Nick.
It was not The Flash. It just wasn't. I hated it.
Don't want any. Mm-mm. But the studio
I don't
is not
want
stopping
your Flash.
The studio is not stopping with The Flash. They are moving ahead with their other projects, and the next one around the corner, the next one around the bend, is the Joaquin Phoenix-led Joker film by writer-director Todd Phillips, my namesake. And Mr. Phillips says that his version of the Clown Prince of Crime has an entirely new origin story not derived from the comics. Phillips actually told Empire, "We didn't follow anything from the comic books, which people are going to be mad about. We wrote our own version of where a guy like the Joker might come from. That's what was interesting to me. We're not even really doing Joker, but the story of becoming Joker. It's about this man, Arthur Fleck, as we find out in the trailer." So, I've had a couple days to think on this, Nick, and I'm still not 100% sure where I sit on it. What are your thoughts on Phillips' comments and this direction of the Joker movie? I think I know where I'm at on it, but I'll let you voice your opinion and see if you sway me one way or the other.
This doesn't really change anything for me. Danielle, my wife, had not seen the Joker trailer until we went to see Spider-Man Far From Home. And so we went and – or not Spider-Man Far From Home. What did we see? We saw something else recently.
The Joker trailer did play before Spider-Man.
It did, but there was something else that we saw that it played before, and I'm having trouble. Oh, it was attached to our in-game re-release, and she had not seen it because when we saw in-game initially, there was no IMAX version of the trailer. So we had only seen in-game in IMAX, and most recently we saw the re-release in standard. Anyway – so she had not seen the trailer before, and after it was over, you know, she had heard me talk about it, and she was like, "Wait a minute, you're not looking forward to that?" And I was like, I think this trailer makes the movie look good, and yet I still wish it didn't exist. And for me, it's always going to come back to that fundamental issue of, I think giving the Joker an origin story is reductive to the character, and I feel that way about any attempt to give him an origin story. The only one that even comes close is the Killing Joke, and that's not necessarily because of the particular origin story they tell, but because of the way they approach it and the Joker himself saying, "This may not even be true." Like, you have to have that ambiguity in there. So understanding this film is going to dispense with that ambiguity entirely, seemingly anyway. Maybe they have some great twist in mind that we're not seeing. That's always going to be a hurdle for me to get over. Yes. And whether the movie is good or not is not really going to impact my appreciation for a Joker origin story, I don't feel. So to me, not pulling one from the comics, that doesn't matter to me, because I don't want one that's even pulled from the comics. I don't want it at all. Is where I come down on it. It would be like if they straight up adapted Wolverine origins for you. Like, so what that it came from a comic? I don't want that either, you know?
Right.
That's where I'm at on it. This doesn't really change anything for me. I still think the movie looks good. I'm going to see it. I'm probably going to enjoy it to a certain degree, but I still question the why of it all.
That's fair. All that is very fair. I come down now, having thought about it, it did give me pause that he said they're not taking anything from the comics, because ultimately it is a comic book character. However, if you're going to tell a Joker origin story, and you're going to do it, I mean, I'm kind of okay with it. Do your own thing. Because Ledger's Joker was his own, it was inspired from the comics, but was his own man, right, by and large. And I think there's never really been a good Joker origin.
That's what I was about to say. If you were going to pull one from the comics, what would you want him to do? I mean,
Killing Joke, I guess. But even that's sort of almost passe at this point. You know, right, it's been done. And so do your own thing. It's not going to really – I'm like you. I'm kind of to the point where I don't – I kind of wish the movie – I wish they're making a movie of an actual DC hero or a DC character that needs his own movie standalone. But I think the movie looks intriguing, and I think there's a better chance of it being good if they just tell a good story and do their movie. Well, there's a good chance, Nick, that I leave this movie theater saying that had absolutely nothing to do with the Joker, and yet it was a great movie.
Yeah, so, exactly. That's a great way to describe it. As a comic book fan, my expectations are very low. As someone who just likes movies and stories told cinematically, this looks interesting. Like, it seems like something that, like, if this movie were called anything else, it looks like something I'd be really into. So I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we have to end the rundown with a bummer, a sad story to report. That is that Lois and Clark actor Eddie Jones, who portrayed Pa Kent, Jonathan Kent, in Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman back in the 90s, has passed away at the age of 82. So we wanted to include this from my standpoint, because I was a big Lois and Clark fan, watched every episode as a kid, and he was the defining Pa Kent of that era for many, many years, until John Schneider's Pa Kent on Smallville came along. He was always what I pictured from the comic book. And in many ways, it was like the Pa Kent of the John Byrne era walked off the comic book and onto the screen with Eddie Jones. He always had that ability to make you feel like he was in some ways your father or your grandfather, as he was there to look out for Clark and give him life lessons, always being supportive, never crossing the line into trying to live Clark's life for him. He was very effective in that stately elder role on the show. And so for a generation of kids and a generation of comic book fans, he really meant a lot. And it's always a shame whenever you lose anyone from the Superman family of media, which have always found a way to strike a chord with the populace. And definitely Eddie Jones will be missed. There have been some great tributes on Twitter, one from Dean Cain I saw. So check that out if you get a chance. And this entire series is available on the DC Universe streaming app. So might be a good time to marathon some episodes.
Well said, sir. I don't have much of a memory of this guy. Was never the world's greatest Lois and Clark fan, as you know. So, but I know he had a big impact on your life. So, always hate to see one of these beloved actors go out. So, yeah, as a tribute, go out and watch some Lois and Clark on DCU.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to the segment where we talk about what we've been reading and watching. It's that segment known worldwide, internationally, as Le Reading and Le Watching.
reading and watching. What you been reading and watching? What you been reading and watching?
Nick, have you been reading anything?
No.
Nor have I. But have you been watching anything?
As I said earlier, I saw the Avengers in-game Bring Back event, the Bring Back re-release they did before the 4th of July holiday in an attempt to make one last push at the all-time box office record currently held by Abaddon. And, yeah, enjoyed the film all over again. The quote, bonus content that was hyped up, perhaps a little underwhelming, but I love that movie so much that I didn't care. It is the best way I can describe it. Like, I had no issue taking the time out of my life to go watch that movie again, despite the relatively lackluster bonus content. So, enjoyed it. Love that movie.
Excellent news to know that it still stands up. Now, do we have any update on its pursuit of Abaddon?
I believe at last count, it's like 20 to 30 million behind. It's really close. You know, the problem is Far From Home is probably going to soak up what little business was still out there for it. But I think the conventional thinking is at this point that subsequent theatrical re-releases for marathons and like special screenings and stuff like that will eventually get it over the number. The problem is going to be Avatar is going to do the same thing whenever its sequels finally come out years from now. There'll probably be Avatar marathons and re-releases and things of that sort. So it might be one of those situations where these two, you know, trade that number one spot back and forth for some time.
Perhaps showing off their fighting spirit with one another. Well, I have been watching some things as well, Nick, if you don't mind ceding the floor to me for a moment.
I'm going to cede your floor here in a couple of nights.
Yes, I'm aware. And you better be mopping it up too. I am going to be talking about Supergirl, the CW television series Supergirl, which I have continued my attempts to catch up on Netflix, which, by the way, I have to say, I'm not going to do this because I love these CW shows and I love reviewing them here on the show and talking about them with Nick as they happen. However, Nick, there's really something to be said as somebody who doesn't have a regular cable and doesn't have the ability to DVR the CW shows during the week. There's really something to be said for waiting until the end of the season and watching them all on Netflix instead of watching them on the CW app, because losing the ads makes these shows just so much easier to watch. Like,
I think it's losing the repetition of the ads is the big thing.
Oh, like, God.
If it were different ads sprinkled throughout, it wouldn't be as big a deal. But there's only so many times you can catch the latest car commercial or the latest truth commercial before you just want to blow your brains out.
If I never see another Liberty Mutual commercial in my life.
Limu Emu. And Doug.
Good Lord. Enough, folks. Enough, people. For God's sake.
Emo just gets a little confused whenever he sees another bird that looks exactly like him, Craig.
Or the guy that jumps into the water or whatever, like, because he threw his phone over there. We're stupid. End it. End all these stupid commercials. And the truth, at least they're not doing the truth commercial anymore. Mm-hmm. But that's beside the point. Anyway, I've been watching Supergirl. It's a breeze on Netflix. I highly recommend it. There's nothing quite like a shorn scrotum. And I can't remember what we talked about last time on the show and what I talked to you offline about, but I did watch what I think may be the best episode ever of Supergirl, which is the House of L.
I think we talked about this last time on the show.
Episode 16.
Or not last time, 2 weeks ago.
And that was phenomenal. The follow-up episode, All About Eve, was also very good, as they are the main characters are searching for Eve Tessmacher to find more information. We also get Lena and Supergirl working through their issues. Thought it was a very good episode. Jean leaves the planet. All good stuff. Nothing wrong with that. The next episode was titled Crime and Punishment, and this was solid enough. This was a solid enough episode. It was very Lena-focused. They end up breaking into Supergirl as Kara infiltrates the prison and interviews Lex's cell neighbor to try to get information about him. The Children of Liberty get deputized. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. There's also a god-awful subplot where James Olsen has PTSD and is also developing superpowers that I could not care less about. And then I end up caring about, but caring about in the wrong way because I hate it. I want nothing to do with it. Also, don't like his sister character being added onto the show. They're clearly hinting at a very forced relationship between her and Alex. Don't like it. In any event, the following episode, episode 19, is titled American Dreamer. And this is where, in my opinion, we hit a big-time drop-off in quality. Actually, it started in Crime and – I take that back. It started in Crime and Punishment. The one that I just talked about and said was okay. To me, that was actually a big drop-off episode. It was all the stuff with James's PTSD I didn't like. I didn't like some of the other subplots going on. And then American Dreamer, to me, was a bad episode because it was Supergirl at its worst. When Supergirl is at its worst is when it's also at its preachiest. And this felt like one of those message episodes that they do on occasion. When they do them subtly, they're very good. But in this case, I felt like they really missed the boat on this episode. I was bored the entire time. Part of it is that I'm not super invested in the Dreamer character yet. But also, James is such a huge part of this episode. There were some good scenes involving him, but overall, not an episode that I particularly enjoyed. I did like the ending. They end it with an interesting cliffhanger as Lena and Supergirl discover Lex's link to Kasnia, and they head off that direction. So looking at the list of episodes, it looks like I have three more episodes to go before I can discuss the conclusion of the season. I think you haven't even watched the finale yet, have you?
I have not. I have not watched the finale yet.
We'll have to sync that up. Mm-hmm. So anyway, those are my thoughts on those episodes. You probably don't remember them, but they happened and you watched them at some point.
Indeed.
All right. Well, with that being said, folks, I can't help but to look at the illuminated sands in the hourglass, which indicate that these are the days of our lives, and that also it's time for the wrestling undetermined amount of time. A lot going on, Nick. A lot going on that we've missed. So we had, since the last time we talked on the show, we've had, let's just try to take this chronologically here. We've had AEW Fighter Fest.
We did.
Which took place in Daytona Beach, an area we're now quite familiar with after last year.
Absolutely.
Good show, I thought, overall. Certainly not to the level of Double or Nothing, but a good show.
Absolutely. It is a really good show, considering it was one of my favorite F words, Conrad, free.
So, it was free, and that was great.
Yeah,
it was
like
a free night of wrestling entertainment.
A free night of Saturday Night Wrestling that's just, you know, yeah, I enjoyed it. It had some angles on it. The pre-show was not to everyone's liking, as we've discussed.
I hid from the pre-show. I did not watch the pre-show, Conrad. Yeah. I actually did. I didn't watch the pre-show, not just because I forgot it was coming on. And so I made it back in time to watch the actual main show.
I do wonder how it played. You know, you and I attended NEO, or it's not NEO,
CEO
Cross New Japan last year, which featured the first encounter between CEO Jabali, yes,
Alex
and
Jabali.
Michael Nakazawa. So there actually was a precedent there, but I would imagine that a lot of the people who watched Double or Nothing and then tuned
never
in for
watched
this
that New Japan
had
show.
No idea who this Jabali fuck was, and so that was probably very confusing for people. But back to the point, all in all, once again, a really good show, especially once you hit that closing stretch of Cody and Darby Allin, Lucha Bros and Laredo Kid against Young Bucks and Kenny Omega. And then, of course, Moxley and Janela was outstanding as well. So you know, they've already proven an ability to deliver when it comes to the top of their cards.
And what I like about their approach to wrestling is, so far anyway, we don't know what it's going to turn into. Yes, there's stuff that doesn't work. And there's going to be stuff. There's going to be stuff on the show that doesn't work for people. That there was stuff on that show that I thought, gosh, I'd be good never seeing that again. But the beauty of it is, at no point did I consider turning off the show because I knew that there would be something for me elsewhere. So, for instance, I wasn't very high on Moxley and Janela.
I liked it a lot.
I didn't get it, I guess. I didn't really understand the story that they were trying to tell in that match. But I loved –
they weren't trying to tell a story. It was an old – it's like it was a Combat Zone match. It was a Combat Zone.
Right. And yeah, to me, if I'm gonna watch a hardcore match, there's got to be a story to it for me to enjoy it, because it's the same way when I go back and watch old Sabu matches and stuff. But that being said, I freaking loved Cody and Darby Allin. Absolutely loved it. And then I loved the six-man tag.
What did you like most about it, Greg?
What did I like most about Cody and Darby Allin?
Yeah. What did you like most about it?
I feel like you're setting me up for something, but I'm not sure what.
Whatever happened, Greg, to a what?
Oh, a time limit draw. Yes. Whatever happened? What's wrong? What is wrong in wrestling with a time limit draw?
Yeah,
folks, it's a good way. It's a good way to get people over. You protect both competitors without doing a bullshit finish written by some group of people whose nuts would fit into a thimble.
Ah, that's good stuff.
No, I thought the commentary was good for the most part all night long. The six-man tag was really good. The women's match. Holy, we haven't even talked about that. The triple threat women's
match. So much better than the triple threat or fatal four-way from Double or Nothing. Yes.
Absolutely.
It just goes to show, you and I have discussed this, the Stardom / Joshi imports are so far ahead of the American AEW roster right now that it's not even – it's laughable. Like, sign as many of those ladies as you can and sign them now.
Yeah, they're so good. They are – like, it's just a different level of pro wrestling. They're positioning, their timing, and I don't want to what's the lady's name? The
Nyla Rose.
Nyla Rose. I don't want to undersell her either. She was great in this match. Mm. She's still, I think, finding herself and finding her character and everything. But she was really good in this match at playing the Vader role, pretty much. That spot where she did the knee drop off the middle rope to the one girl that was hanging over the top rope, outstanding. Mm-hmm. I think they've got something with her. They just perhaps it could be argued that they can be booking her a little bit better than they are, but. That was a great match. I really loved it. Anyway, that's Fyter Fest. Let's move past that. Then we got hit with, I don't know if you'd agree with this, Nick, maybe other than the creation of AEW, the biggest wrestling news story in the last probably year. Well, okay, the Fox deal. But in terms of what affects our interest,
creatively. Yeah, I was going to say, this is up there with the Fox deal to me. The Fox deal is a big deal financially. This is a big deal on a multitude of levels that we can – you know, probably not discuss in depth in the time allotted here, but
indeed, Paul Heyman has been announced as the executive director of Monday Night Raw, and Eazy-E, Eric Bischoff has been named as the executive director of SmackDown Live. Now, what does this mean? We still don't entirely know, but what we do know is that according to the reliable reporters in wrestling, Dave Meltzer and Wade Keller,
Sports Illustrated.
And Sports Illustrated, Paul Heyman and Eric Bischoff will be the driving creative forces behind Raw and SmackDown, still reporting to Vince McMahon, who has the final say, which is a concern among many. But this was such a huge story, Nick. I know we were talking about it the day that it broke and talked pretty much for our entire lunch conversation about this.
Yeah.
About this and the ramifications that it might have.
Yeah, because it's interesting because it really is. It's one story that has so many different facets to it. Again, the buck still stops Vince McMahon, which is clearly the biggest issue here, but it hints at a desire to give each program an independent feel, a different creative direction, and to get back to that era. You know, I said this to you during that conversation we had that day. WWE has been trying the brand split off and on for the last 17 years now. And to me, it was at its most successful during those early phases where WWE actually encouraged the two brands to compete against one another. Separate writing teams, separate rosters, internal competition, you know, competing just for the pride of putting on a better show or a better product than the guy in the office down the hall from you. And if we can get back to that, to where there's a personal investment from who, you know, Heyman and Bischoff in this case, I think that can lend itself to a really, really good show.
Yeah, I agree. And we still, I think it's going to take time, clearly. In the time since this announcement, we had what I thought was a very good Raw last week.
Right.
Which had Paul Heyman's fingerprints all over it. And then this week, they came back with an episode that may have had his fingerprints on it or not. I don't know. But an episode that was not good at all.
But so, I think every episode of WWE television since this was announced, and maybe this is just, you know, us looking to attach more importance to these things than there actually is thus far, has had something that feels like it's a little different. Like it's a little more out there. It's a little edgier. It's a little newer. It's a little fresh. Like it doesn't. There's been at least one or two segments on every show that don't feel like the same WWE programming we've been watching for essentially the last 8 years.
Yes, whether it's been edgier content, whether it's been featuring different players, or whether it has been rehabilitating certain individuals that have not been booked well, like Bobby Lashley on an otherwise lackluster episode of Raw this week, continued from last week. Some rehabilitative booking.
I'm really excited to watch this week's SmackDown, reading what is happening on the show right now.
Oh, wow. Got to get to that. And then we've seen the likes of Ricochet being positioned as a main event talent. The reformation of the club, which was a great moment last week. And Gallows and Anderson now being featured heavily. The Revival being featured heavily. So good stuff, at least promising. Now, I do believe that in order for this to work the way that you want it to and the way that I want it to, which is that spirit of competition, they have to end the wild card rule,
yes,
right?
Absolutely. And I think they will. Well, they can't immediately because they had already booked a pay-per-view with the wild card rule in effect. But I think a lot of people have speculated that you'll see most of these changes implemented after SummerSlam. And there have been rumors the last few years of a second superstar shakeup after SummerSlam that hasn't panned out the last couple of years. And also, usually there are some NXT call-ups after SummerSlam. So maybe after SummerSlam, you could get a refreshing and a more concrete set of rosters. And I think that would go a long way towards solving the problem.
And it would be so fun because, you know, Paul Heyman has done an interview talking about one of the turning points in his run on SmackDown creative was when Raw said, hey, we're going to take Chris Jericho from you. And he said, all right, well, I want Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero in return. And he got laughed at, but he got him, and it ended up creating that SmackDown 6 era that we all remember fondly. So I think that could be really fun. And especially one thing that I don't think will ever happen, especially in the modern era where there's so many in-company romantic relationships behind the scenes, you don't want to break couples up, but I think it would be cool if they did like a legitimate real life draft special on the network. Like each, like Eric and Paul in a war room, legitimately drafting these people, not in a predetermined way. It would be so fun. But anyway, that's
including like NXT prospects that they could, even if they didn't call them up, if they could like draft the rights to NXT guys and leave them in NXT, and then when they're ready to come up, they come up to Raw or SmackDown. That'd be really cool.
Agreed completely. Well, we don't want to leave out.
Or what if, you know, instead you gave somebody the ability to do that in a video game, and then
so you're saying that you would give the user of the video game, the player of the video game, the ability to be the general manager of a brand.
Yes, and then you would have the two compete against each other for, you know, to put on quality shows, high-rated shows, merchandise dollars. You could really pick a variety of factors to judge a true winner by. And, of course, the winner would always be me.
Well, we both know that would never happen, but mainly the fact of you being the winner. But also, it would probably just never happen in general. But if it does, they will have my dollars and my cents. But we don't want to leave New Japan Pro Wrestling out of the equation by any means, because this is arguably the hottest time of the year for New Japan Pro Wrestling. And I got to say, Nick, after what feels like New Japan's kind of been floating under the radar pretty much since January in terms of people talking about it, suddenly they're the talk of the town again because it's G1 time.
And they're following up a damn fine Dominion card as well. They had a lot of momentum coming out of even going back to Best of the Super Juniors, because you had the Best of the Super Juniors that wound up with the debut of Jon Moxley winning the IWGP United States title, leading right in to Will Ospreay having a fantastic performance in Best of the Super Juniors, leading right into Kenta making his return at Dominion, and all of this rolling straight into Dominion. So, the G1. So, first night of the G1's in the books, and as you're about to say, I thought it was a damn fine piece of business, as it were.
Absolutely. They have unveiled the first G1 climax matches that took place in America. And they kicked off the entire summer's G1 tournament in Dallas, Texas this past weekend, live on Access TV, with just an outstanding, outstanding wrestling show for the fans there in attendance, including a pretty surprising performance, at least to us. Now, I know there's some people out there probably that are hardcore New Japan fans that watch all the shows that might say, well, we knew Lance Archer had this in him. I didn't know Lance Archer had this in him.
No, that was outstanding.
That was a phenomenal career performance from him against Will Ospreay, who many people have said is the best in the world right now. They had a great match. I thought that Kota Ibushi and Kenta had a really good match, where it was Kenta's kind of reacclimation to the Japanese style of wrestling, and he certainly came in and he certainly delivered some stiffski kicks to old
laid his shit in, kid.
Yes, laid his shit in, so to speak. Zack Sabre Jr., the brilliant Zack Sabre Jr. and Sonata having a technical masterpiece.
I need the Mohawk back. I need the Mohawk back.
For who? Sonata?
For Sonata, yeah. Just not the same. Not the same.
But that was a hell of a match. Hell of a match. And then, of course, the peerless legends, Kazuchika Okada and Hiroshi Tanahashi, tearing down the house with another great match. Not one of their best matches that they've had, but that's only because they've had some of the greatest matches in the history of wrestling against each other. So another phenomenal main event match between those guys. Okada is firing on all cylinders, loaded with charisma. His English is getting better. So interesting to see New Japan kind of stake its claim in Dallas. The attendance wasn't what they would have liked, but I think anytime you put on a show that good, it's going to make people want to show up the next time.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. I was going to say, we need to let people know we are this weekend going to be in Jacksonville, Florida for a live Grillin' JR. And on Saturday night, we're going to be there in attendance for AEW Fight for the Fallen. Particularly looking forward to the Rhodes Brothers versus Young Bucks match.
Absolutely. Can't wait. And that has been the Wrestling Quarter Hour.
Indeed so. Well, Nick, gosh, what do we have coming the people's way?
Oh, we're going to wrap up Spider Month, as we've talked about earlier, with a special look back, an off-page at Sam Raimi's first Spider-Man film. Wrap up Spider-Man Month with a long book hunt on Kraven's Last Hunt, one of the most iconic Spider-Man stories that Greg and I have never actually read before. And then we'll get into the month of August, which will hold something.
Isn't it good?
Yes, it is.
Well, I guess that's about it for us then, right, Nick?
That is about it. But tonight we're going to let you go in honor of our upcoming, as Greg just said, we're going to be in Jacksonville, Florida this very weekend to see good old our good friend and friend of the show, good old Hall of Famer Jim Ross live. And as a thank you for letting us attend his show as a close personal friend of ours, we thought we'd give him an opportunity on our show to talk about one of his favorite products that he has been endorsing over on Grilling JR. And so here with a little bit of a different take on the classic 90s country song Blue by LeAnn Rimes, ladies and gentlemen, WWE Hall of Famer, good old JR, Jim Ross.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction. I appreciate that. And by the way, tickets still available this weekend for our show there in Jacksonville, the hotel. We're going to have a good one there. Being me and O'Connor. Oh, my boy, love those Chiefs. We're going to be there. We're going to answer questions. We're going to talk about whatever we want to talk about, folks. Some stuff that may not even make the podcast. Stuff that might be too raunchy for television, for radio, for podcast, whatever the hell you want to say. But that being aside there, let's put that aside for a moment. You're also going to have a group of young men, defiant young males, perhaps, who are going to try to make a mark at the AEW show. And this is a time when you want to be able to tell a story, slow it down just a little bit, tell a story, and really get yourself quote-unquote over. Because you're not quote-unquote over until you can sell tickets. Anyway, let's get started on this song. Blue, it's called Blue Chew. Oh, so lonesome for you. Now, why can't you pour Blue Chew all over me? Blue Chew, you'll never be lonesome, no you. Tears fill my eyes till I can't see. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm sitting in bed on my Casper mattress, and I just cannot complete the journey, folks. You follow me here? Like, I'm on the goal line, and I just can't get there. I just can't cross the goal line. So when that happens, I reach over to that little pill, and here I am, sitting here, so lonely, so lonesome that I could cry. And that little Blue Chew makes me no longer lonesome for you. That right then, I just blow all over myself. Well, now that it's over, I realize that those weak words you whispered were nothing but lies. Those words, of course, were that Blue Chew doesn't get the job done. Folks, I guarantee it'll get the job done. Blue Chew, oh, so lonesome for you. Why can't you have Blue Chew right with me? Why can't the both of us get together now and have some Blue Chew?
Our traveling fanboys.